This morning is case number 71402, Commissioner Cooper versus State with Ms. DeSoto for the appellant, Ms. Lewis for the respondent. Ms. DeSoto.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Sally DeSoto. I work in Nevada State Public Defender's Office. I'm representing the appellant, Kamisha Cooper. This case is about fairness and due process. The court is familiar with the facts, so in quick summary, the issue centers around the appellant, a probationer, who was before the court facing alleged probation violations and more specifically laws, or at least one of them. She had previously been arrested in Elko, and those charges had been dismissed without prejudice. At the revocation hearing, Ms. Cooper was unable to testify in her own defense or face the possibility of self-incrimination if the charges against her were later refiled in Elko. The issue before this court focuses on two parts, and they're kind of intertwined. The first is the Fifth Amendment violation issue, where she couldn't testify unless she gave up the right of future trial proceeding. And the second is the reduced burden of the prosecutor. The court has previously created a rule in Del V. State which deals with the burden of the prosecutor and limiting the prosecutor's use of the revocation proceedings as a vehicle to obtain information to be used later in trial. However, this kind of only protects the defendant if the prosecutor is unscrupulous and decides, you know, otherwise it doesn't protect them if they decide to testify on their own behalf at the probation revocation hearing at that lower level burden. I mean, then that testimony can later be used in that criminal trial. And generally, a defendant weighs, you know, the evidence at a criminal trial at that higher burden before deciding whether they're going to testify on their own behalf and protect their rights. As to the Fifth Amendment issue, in Dell, the court exercised judicial restraint and left the issue of the Fifth Amendment violation to the legislature. Here it is, almost 40 years later. The legislature has not acted. The U.S. Supreme Court stated in Morrissey v. Brewer that a probationer or a parolee has certain rights, including the opportunity to appear and speak on their own behalf. In Coleman, the Supreme Court stated that it is apparent that the policy served by the due process guarantee of an opportunity to be heard at this probation revocation hearing are impinged when he declines to avail himself of the chance for fear of self-incrimination. The United States Supreme Court has also held that an individual is subjected to a practice that, when they are subjected to a practice that denies them a free choice to admit, to deny, or to refuse to answer, that any statement is considered involuntary. And we contend that the procedures that denies the probationer this free choice is unconstitutional.
Mr. Soto, let me, can I?
Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Soto, again, I think six of us were former district judges. We probably did hundreds of revocation hearings, you know, in our previous life. But isn't it in Carson City a lot of times to avoid this problem? I think the state and the defense negotiates a stipulated set of facts and submits them to the judge to avoid having the probationer have to testify and all, and then the judge can make a legal conclusion, you know, whether revocation is appropriate. I don't know if you do that in Carson City or if it
was not done in this case. I don't know how often this issue arises.
Well, I'm sure I was just thinking this has to come up because a lot of times that's why they're in on the revocation, you know.
I do know that in the parole revocation proceedings that we do at the prison before the parole board, if they have pending cases, we continue it out until the case has, concluded, and then they go before the parole board again.
I see.
So, you know, that necessarily doesn't happen where they, you know, stipulate to certain facts, and that certainly didn't happen here. I don't believe that the defendant, because of that lower burden, even got to present.
Did your client ask to be able to have you or whomever on his behalf stipulate to certain facts with the district attorney, and then the district attorney could see if they would accept that stipulation and then argue whether that's grounds for revocation.
Not that I'm aware of, but certainly the district attorney, the deputy district attorney that's here today, she was the attorney at the hearing, so she probably could answer that better than I can. I do know that...
let me ask you a question kind of on the point of Dale, and you could recognize it's fairly well on point.
Right.
And in that case, the court recognized the tension, but found that the current practice didn't present any constitutional issue. And my understanding is in most jurisdictions, that's the way it's understood and that's the way it's practiced.
And agreed, you know, as for the federal court, you know, I think they're held to a higher standard if there's no constitutional issue and they found there wasn't. Then they kind of have to rule a certain way. But the courts have the supervisory power. They address that under Coleman. They address that in Dale in a footnote. So they could go beyond that if they feel that it's unfair, if they feel that, you know, they need to, you know, enforce certain protections. You know, the state courts can make these decisions where the federal courts are kind of limited. And I think you see that in the cases that they have moved to protect the probationers or the parolees, whatever the case, it is a state court that's making those decisions.
And would you agree that you're requesting that we recognized immunity in this case, use immunity, and that's a policy decision, isn't it?
Well, we don't really have use immunity in Nevada. I think the district attorney probably has more, experience with the use of the immunity they have. But my understanding is that it's usually done by contract, that they contract under the pre-agreement with a defendant in order to have them testify in another case. I don't know if the court actually has to use immunity. If you look at United States v. Simmons, they just held that the testimony that a defendant testifies in a suppression hearing can't later be used against him in a trial. I don't know, and I know that's based on a constitutional issue, but, you know, we would argue that there is a constitutional issue, that they're being violated of their constitutional right to testify or make that choice.
But under the current existing law, that's not the case.
True. So, you know, the state in their response did argue, though, that the court should fashion a rule that prevents this unfair situation from happening, and that's kind of what we're asking today, is that the court fashion a rule based on whether they're going to just take their supervisory powers and fashion the rule accordingly, that the testimony can't be used later in a later proceeding under that higher burden, or if they're going to find that it's unconstitutional, and we believe it is unconstitutional.
So you're asking us to either overrule the Dale case or to...
Right, in the alternative.
Judicially create a species of use immunity.
Yeah, we believe that under Morrissey that you're being denied that right. That's a constitutional right that Morrissey...
But we'd have to overrule the Dane case to get there for you.
I'm sorry?
We'd have to overrule the case cited in the supplemental authorities.
You would. And once again,
that case was
40 years old. And the judicial court at that time left it up to the legislature to make a decision regarding the Fifth Amendment. That was part of the basis for denying that. And the legislature hasn't acted. So we don't have any protections in place for the probationers to testify or to decide, to voluntarily decide whether they want to testify on their behalf.
Mr. Soto?
Yes.
If you're asking the court essentially to resolve this on policy grounds, if we say going on Dale and not having an appetite necessarily to overturn Dale, there's not a constitutional conflict. Would you be suggesting, if that's where we go, would you be suggesting that we adopt something similar to 47090, which is the immunity, so to speak, that we use in motions to suppress or motions to challenge a confession? Is that the type?
That is the type of immunity I'm suggesting the court consider putting in place, yes. Are there any other questions? I know I'm kind of early, but...
Thank you. About 5.5 minutes left. Ms. Lewis?
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Kristen Lewis. I represent the respondent, State of Nevada, in this matter. And I'm asking the court to affirm the decision of the district court who revoked appellant's probation in this particular case. I would like to note, I guess at the beginning, in making decisions to revoke a person's probation, the district court has broad discretion in making that decision. And those decisions typically are not disturbed absent abuse of discretion. I would submit to the court that there was no abuse of discretion in this particular case, nor was there a due process violation that took place. When we look at what the Supreme Court has considered in evaluating probation violation proceedings, parole revocation proceedings, what they looked at was the hearing is designed to be a narrow inquiry to determine whether or not the probationer's conduct violated the conditions of probation and whether or not that violation warrants revocation. These hearings were never intended to be at the same level as a criminal trial, and they're not part of the criminal prosecution.
In that same vein, in a probation revocation proceeding, oftentimes it is that discussion about guilty with an explanation. I mean, the defendant giving that mitigating, their own mitigating or their side of the story to the judge is very influential in terms of the judge determining whether they're going to reinstate probation or whether they're not. So when we blanket, if we cut that out anytime there's a laws violation, is there a way to reconcile that so the judge gets to hear the why from the probationer without the probationer having to give up their Fifth Amendment rights on the crime?
Your Honor, I think that's an important question to ask, and it's interesting because that question has actually been raised not just in the context of probation violation proceedings, but other types of proceedings, and it was addressed in the McGautha versus California case, where a defendant might be facing criminal proceedings in one state and another state that might be going at different times, or might be facing state prosecution and federal prosecution. And defendants in those types of situations are always forced to make a choice as to whether or not to exercise a particular right. I guess the issue in this particular case is the defendant wasn't deprived from having the opportunity to testify. It's just the fact that that testimony could then potentially be later used in a subsequent prosecution if that prosecution arises. Those choices have not been found to violate the due process provisions of the Constitution, even in the case of those trial proceedings. So I would submit to the court when we're dealing with the more flexible probation violation hearing, noting that probation is a legislative grant of leniency that's provided to a person, it's even less so. And I would submit to the court that if you look at, and I believe part of the transcript that was provided to the court indicated that not only did the defendant at the time of the hearing make a statement to the court, which she did, and she didn't elaborate on any of the actual laws and conduct issues, but she did speak to the court about some of the particular constraints that she had in her life. So she did have that opportunity to make those statements and was not subject to any cross-examination by the state. So I think that those are important considerations. The concern is if we look at the Coleman case or we look to carve out a particular...
Excuse me, before you go on to that part of your argument, but my understanding of the record is that Cooper was advised by our counsel. Our counsel reported that Cooper had been advised not to testify to the circumstances of the arrest.
That's correct.
Because of the risk associated with implicating the self-incrimination problem. So that is part of the record, correct?
That's part of the record.
So to the extent that Cooper would say anything on the record, she'd be at risk one way or another.
Potentially. But again, as the McGautha court indicated, those
so it seems to put counsel and the defendant in an awkward position. You're trying to mitigate the consequences of a probation revocation. At the same time, you're trying to avoid criminal liability for the issues that brought you there.
I don't disagree, but the more that you carve out exceptions to address those particular aspects, the more you elevate a probation violation proceeding to the same level as a trial. One of the other things that defense counsel...
Why shouldn't we view it the same way we view a suppression hearing and what's wrong with the rule that is contained in the Supreme Court case in Coleman?
There's nothing wrong with it, except that this court has previously considered that particular issue and declined not to go along the lines of the Coleman case, basically indicating that a defendant has an opportunity to present an adequate defense.
I don't know that it's necessary for us to revisit Dial or Deal or however you pronounce it. It looks like the court simply punted on the issue to the legislature, didn't decide it.
To some extent, they indicated that's something that could be left to the legislature, but they also indicated that it doesn't substantially undermine the defendant's ability to defend against the probation violation allegations, that they have the ability to question witnesses that are presented, they have the ability to provide a defense and to present any mitigating evidence.
A lot of the practical aspects or pragmatic aspects of probation revocation is that these new offenses or these violations occur in the context of where there is no witness or there are no documents. Someone reuses or uses when they shouldn't be using, or they're caught within contraband that they shouldn't have in their possession. And the only explanation that's going to be offered in those instances is going to come from the defendant themselves, that it's a roommate's
pants.
Contraband or it ain't me, babe, whatever it is. And so the ability of the defendant to respond to probation revocation violations is very challenging. And as we all know, those probation agreements have, some 20, 30 provisions as a general matter beyond what the judge has even ordered about what you can or cannot do. I just think that it becomes very difficult for someone to successfully defend or explain a probation revocation issue unless they're able to do it themselves.
I understand what the court's saying. Again, I think those challenges are contained in many situations, not just probation violation proceedings, and they've not been found to be of constitutional magnitude.
If we were to extend this rule as they did in Coleman or extend the statutory approach taken with suppression, what would be an unintended consequence that the state would be concerned about?
Well, I can only speak to this particular case right now. I would ask the court specifically if it's considering that type of a carve-out exception that took place in Coleman, not to apply it retroactively, because in this particular case, we've already had testimony that was presented by the prosecutor in Elko, the law enforcement officer who stopped Ms. Cooper. And to go back and have to address those issues would require the state wanting possibly rebuttal testimony, trying to gather witnesses and evidence again. So if the court does consider it, I would ask that would apply prospectively and not retroactively.
Do you see any unintended consequences in the adoption of the rule going forward?
What I see in this particular case, and it's not even just this issue, because if you look at the record, the defense attorney at the time said many things. She said, I'm advising my client not to testify because we don't know when these charges might come back or if they'll come back or if this proceeding is intended to be something that creates an investigative tool for Elko to use in their prosecution. The other thing she said is, and they dismissed their charges because they need to engage in further investigation in order to possibly bring those charges. And I don't have that full investigative report, and I don't have that full knowledge. So then it gets to the point where not only are we talking about consideration of the defendant not having that tension of deciding whether to testify or not testify if that testimony is going to be later used, but then, well, was the attorney sufficiently apprised of all of the information? Are they effective or not effective? Where does the questioning as far as how many protections that we put in place for these proceedings end? When does that proceeding not become a more flexible type of hearing that was intended to be rather than a full trial like a criminal prosecution? Keeping in mind that person's already been prosecuted, they've already been adjudicated, they're on probation for the purpose of monitoring their behavior, allowing rehabilitation to take place, and also protecting the community. I'm just not sure where the inquiry ends at that point in time.
But what's the harm to be avoided?
I'm sorry?
Well, what is the harm to be avoided? So if they give their side of the story, how does that create some problem, either practical impediment or a real impediment to the state for information that, in the case in chief, the new offense, we'll say, you wouldn't necessarily be entitled to the defendant's testimony because they have a Fifth Amendment privilege. Well, what's the harm to be avoided if they get to speak their piece on those issues at the probation revocation, but you can't use it in the criminal case? What's the, how does that either set back a justice, hurt you, create some problem? What is the harm to be avoided?
I think it's a temporary solution. And it's preferable to, it's certainly preferable.
Sorry, I didn't hear your response.
I think it's a temporary solution, and I think it's certainly preferable to delaying the probation revocation proceeding until the end of the criminal trial that could potentially be pending for who knows how long. So that's, and that's the point that the state brought up in the response, because we did address that particular issue. If the court is looking to address the ability for a defendant to be able to make a statement and consider that outside of the constitutional context, it's preferable to go that direction rather than to require the probation revocation proceedings trail in a criminal trial.
Don't we have another pragmatic problem? Maybe people don't perceive this as happening very often, but the probation revocation is enforced, the person is sent to prison, they go to trial on the criminal case, and they're acquitted. Are they entitled to have their probation unwound, their revocation unwound? I've never seen that.
No, Your Honor, and I would submit to the court that this court has found in more than one case that for a laws and conduct violation to be upheld for purposes of a probation violation does not require that that person be convicted of the charges in another trial. The probation violation proceeding is simply intended to be a proceeding to determine whether the probationer's conduct based upon the facts and evidence is as it should be expected given the probation conditions. And that's what it's designed for. It's not supposed to be a mini trial.
Lower standard of proof.
I'm sorry?
Given the lower standard of proof, why not let the defendants say their piece?
I think it changes the very nature of the hearing for the state. I mean, the defendant's able to present virtually anything, and the state's in a position of, it's difficult to challenge or verify that information.
So, but isn't that the point of an ANIA hearing? I mean, I know it isn't used very often, but at least when I was a district court judge, I would say, look, if we have this contest, why aren't we going through an ANIA hearing? Shouldn't we be doing that if there's really a legitimate contest or challenge?
Potentially.
I have a separate question, which is the appellant is relying largely on Coleman for this middle ground, and I don't see in the briefs what how many jurisdictions have adopted Coleman, how many have rejected it. Not talking about the federal system, but looking at it as a state law question. Do you have a sense of that you could relate?
I don't have a sense of the number of jurisdictions that have followed it. I know that there is a split of authority and that some jurisdictions do follow that, allowing for any testimony that's presented by a defendant in a particular case to only be used in the subsequent criminal trial for purposes of impeachment or things of that nature.
And the states that have not followed it, what have they said is the reason for not following it?
They've actually gone back to the rationale in the Morrison versus, the United States Supreme Court's cases in Morrison versus Brewery and I'm forgetting the name of the other one, Gagnon versus Scarpelli, and indicated that what was laid out in those cases is that flexible fundamental due process is what's required, and defendants being able to present a defense, to question witnesses, to be notified of the charges that they're facing, and to present mitigating evidence is what's required. And it's not required constitutionally to be able to testify and not have that testimony used against you in the subsequent proceeding. That's exactly what they've stated.
State courts adopted the Coleman result by court rule? I mean, is there an issue?
Actually, even in the Coleman case, they recognize that exception was not constitutionally mandated. It's a policy determination that's made by the court.
So it could be a rule, it could be a court decision?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further?
Just briefly, in this case, I wanted to just have one closing statement. I've recently had an opportunity to speak with the prosecutor in Elko to see what stage the charges are in, and I think that's relevant to this particular case. They still have not completed their investigation due to the nature of the charges there. And so when this court is looking at whether or not, as I indicated, probation violation proceedings should wait until after an underlying criminal trial takes place, that would certainly lead to a bad result. And the court, in making the determination in this particular case, followed the procedures that were set forth by Dale and the constitutional requirements that were set forth by the Supreme Court.
Well, because you presented that, wouldn't the best strategy be to postpone the probation revocation until after the criminal case is decided? It may not be decided against the defendant.
Those charges may never even be filed.
So how can you allow your client, how can a defense attorney allow the client to testify when the investigation is still going on?
And that investigation, due to the nature of the charges in this particular case, there could be charges that stem from Wyoming, Colorado, and Elko, Nevada. It's hard to know whether or not they'll be proceeded on or not. It's a significant dilemma. And so when a probationer is on probation, there's an interest in rehabilitating their conduct. There's also an interest on the part of the state to protect the community and to make sure that when that behavior is not as it should be based upon the probation violation conditions, that there's a sanction imposed fairly prompt.
So if there's a significant delay between the probation revocation and the new charges, you're saying the public is at risk?
Yes. And I pointed out to the court in the argument in this case that that was definitely the case.
Well, they're at risk when somebody makes bail also. Then, under your thinking, under that thought, if somebody's out of custody on a robbery charge or a sexual assault charge, it's a risk.
Right. But if they violate those bail conditions once they're released and they're brought back before the court, then the courts reassess what that bail should be or if bail should be granted based upon the violation of conditions. And it's the same type of thing that you have when you've got a probationer who's on probation with multiple violations.
Justice Stiglitz, you had something else?
But Ms. Lewis, a decision whether or not to file this continuing investigation might be made easier if they got the defendant's side of the story. Isn't that correct? Is that the whole point? If they go into the probation violation hearing and they incriminate themselves in some fashion, given a different burden of proof and different conversation you're having there, then they'd have that information to use against her in the refiling. Isn't that correct?
I think it depends upon the case. I think in this particular case, whatever the defendant might have said isn't necessarily going to assist the prosecution in the Elko charges because of the nature of those charges. So if the defendant in that case had admitted, yes, I was in the vehicle with another person, and yes, there were all these forged cards, but I didn't know anything about that, I was just traveling with her. I mean, it always depends upon what's said.
You'd agree between those two, if those two policy things, wait or resolve it in this fashion, as we do say MTS, you'd go with the resolve it to give that kind of immunity to the testimony?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis.
Thank you.
Mr. Soto, rebuttal.
You know, I just wanted to point out on Justice Hardesty's remark that was especially true where they didn't have the evidence in this case to use as you know, to cross-examine and use as defense because there was none provided. They were still investigating the case, as the DA testified to. But other than that, unless you have any other questions, I have nothing more to say.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Court thanks Ms. Lewis and Mr. Soto for your arguments and briefs in this matter, and this matter will stand submitted and will be in recess till